Welcome to The Week Ahead in Russia, RFERL's Monday podcast about significant developments and upcoming events in Moscow and beyond. I'm Steve Gutterman, and my guest this week is Moscow correspondent Matthew Luxmoor. Thanks a lot for joining me from the big village, Matthew.
Sure. Thanks for having me, Steve.
All right. Well, the first thing I'd like to talk about is Russia's COVID-19 vaccine and the prospects for that going forward. President Vladimir Putin made a big announcement last week saying that a coronavirus vaccine that Russian scientists have been working on has been approved for use. He said his daughter had been inoculated with it and was doing okay. Now, in case you missed it, that makes Russia the first country to register a vaccine against COVID-19, which has been recorded in more than 900,000 people in Russia and killed more than 15,000. Though the accuracy of those numbers, as we've discussed before, remains in doubt. And now there are also doubts about the Russian vaccine, including or especially, I guess, about the timing of its approval, which came before what are called phase three trials. Matthew, tell us a little bit about the Russian vaccine and how the announcement has been greeted globally.
Sure. The announcement, I mean, it obviously provoked quite a reaction, bearing in mind the stakes that you just outlined, with Russia being the first country to give regulatory approval. But it wasn't necessarily unexpected. I mean, Russia's made various statements in recent months about the apparent progress of its vaccine development efforts, even if the methods used and most of the details have not been shared with Western, in particular British and American scientists. Mm-hmm. So outside of Russia, the announcement that the vaccine had been approved, it elicited obviously quite a lot of skepticism. The main reason, as you said, is Russia. It hasn't conducted all stages of the vaccine testing that the Western scientific community considers a minimum requirement prior to approval. So the way it works is human testing of vaccines typically includes three stages before mass production can be launched. So the first two involve trials on a small group of people to determine whether the vaccine will cause side effects and if it's capable of triggering the immune system. And then the final phase, which is known as phase three, involves thousands of volunteers who are given either the vaccine or a placebo. So the uproar about Russia's vaccine, it focuses on the fact that Russia gave its approval before conducting this final phase three trial, which means a large swathe of the scientific community simply refused to acknowledge Russia's claim of having a working and, most importantly, safe vaccine until this phase three trial is conducted. Skeptics also point to the fact that Russia's announcement, it comes obviously in the heat of a global race to produce a COVID-19 vaccine where, a huge dose of prestige is up for grabs for any country that can successfully release a safe and effective one from mass production. Russia, under Putin, it positioned itself as one of the foremost global powers. And so it understandably also has an interest in winning this battle. The others are, Donald Trump is, enthusiastically backing the U.S.'s own Operation Warp Speed, which, is pumping billions into vaccine research. And China's also making a serious headway with its own efforts. So, to wrap up, I think skepticism about the rapid pace of Russia's vaccine development, especially in the context of years and even decades that it usually takes, it's taken in the past to produce the vaccine, it's not surprising. At the same time, I think the world will obviously be grateful after, hundreds of thousands of deaths and millions of infections we've had so far, if it turns out that Russia really has beaten others to the chase. And, Russia stands to earn not only soft power, but also a good deal of money. If it meets its target to produce 1 billion doses by the end of next year, one estimate I've seen places a potential take at $19 billion. Mm-hmm. So that's a quarter of the total value of the global vaccine market.
So, yeah, to some degree, I guess, as always, follow the money. And you mentioned, you know, I think I've read that there's some questions about when Russia is actually going to kind of make it available or administer it to, you know, massively within Russia. So to some degree, you know, some of the concerns, you know, about it's the fact that it's untested may, you know, may be sort of delayed. In other words, it sounds like the important thing for Moscow in some ways was to make this announcement and then go ahead with the phase three trials. So we'll see. But and again, as you say, you know, the key thing and will be whether it works. But it did strike me that, you know, as you mentioned, it's a race. And I guess major powers are kind of treating it as a race. But, you know, you have Kirill Dmitriev, the head of the Russian Direct Investment Fund, which financed this effort to a large degree, I believe. You know, he's saying it's a Sputnik moment, which is like really kind of going out there. And I think it's called Sputnik 5. So that's really kind of going out there and saying, yeah, this is a geopolitical, you know, race, which I feel like sort of undermines the soft power, you know, effects. But in the end, it's all. Those are kind of words, so they're not, you know, maybe not extremely important.
One thing I think it's also important to mention, I didn't mention it, Russia is going to, at least officially, has said it will conduct phase three trials, and those phase three trials will be conducted in parallel to the release of the vaccine to key workers, such as, you know, hospital workers, I think prior to official start of mass production in October. So the phase three trial will take place, but the announcement was made before it began, which is obviously, as you noted, not the way this is usually done.
Right, I see. Thanks very much. That's useful to know. All right, thanks a lot on that. I guess now the second topic I'd like to discuss is Belarus. It's a bit risky because we're actually recording this on Friday, August 14th. So things could change. There's a lot going on. Strikes at some of the major Belarusian industrial facilities. I believe Lukashenko has just said recently that he is still alive and hasn't gone anywhere. I'm not sure. I just glanced at the news and saw something on that. But essentially, I want to address something that may or may not change, but the stakes for Russia and maybe some pros and cons for the Kremlin of the situation in Belarus, where Lukashenko has cracked down very hard on protests over an election. The state claims handed him a sixth term with more than 80% of the vote. Basically, I see one major pro for the Kremlin and one major potential con. I mean, there's definitely more, but a number of analysts have said that Putin's government wants Lukashenko to hang on to power, but emerge weakened with the opprobrium of the West and what is already clearly vastly diminished support or acceptance from the Belarusian people, because this sort of outcome, Lukashenko remaining in power but being undermined, weakened, would, they say, give Moscow more leverage over him and, you know, over Belarus. And Putin has been seeking to integrate Belarus more closely with Russia. So that would be a plus for the Kremlin, is the way it's seen. On the other hand, this is, I mean, it's a somewhat separate, I guess, point, but it seems to me that whatever the outcome, the protests in Belarus are sending a signal to the Kremlin about the risks of staying in power for years and years. Putin has already done that. He's been in power for more than 20 years as president or prime minister. And now he's given himself the option with the constitutional changes of seeking to stay president until 2036 by running for two more terms. What do you think, Matthew? Does the Kremlin see what's happening in Belarus as a challenge or an opportunity?
I mean, as you say, it's kind of can be viewed from both sides. And, you know, there's been a lot of analysis recently, you know, despite the fact that we can't really know what's going on in the Kremlin ever. But, I mean, I think it's it's certainly a challenge for the Kremlin. You know, the Moscow is it's largely watched from the sidelines as the crisis unfolds, at least as far as what's been happening on the surface. As far as it being an opportunity for Russia, I think it's worth maybe gauging kind of the historical context in which this is all happening. When he first came to power in 1994, you know, in the heady days following the Soviet collapse only 3 years earlier, Lukashenko moved to retain close ties with Moscow, you know, economically, militarily, and culturally too. So the two countries, you know, speak the same language, Russian, since the Belarusian language has steadily eroded under Lukashenko, despite actually quite successful efforts in recent years to revive it. So Belarusian is obviously very much alive still, but the official state language and, you know, the language that most people speak is Russian. And then in the 90s, Belarus and Russia also came closely to integrating fully with each other under Union State, at least, you know, based on official statements. And in Russia, with the ailing President Yeltsin at the helm at the time, there was for some time, you know, widespread speculation that Lukashenko could actually head up the single, you know, the Union State with Russia that could emerge from that pact.
Right.
But that Union State idea, you know, it ended up existing largely on paper alone. And it's only in the last year, amid tensions in Moscow and leading up to the 20th anniversary of that first, signing of the agreement on a roadmap for the Union State, that the ideas actually come up again as, a potential mechanism through which the two countries could seek closer ties. Lukashenko, he's been in power for, by that time, by last year, he'd been in power for a quarter of a century, now 26 years. And Putin was also seeking ways that he could create an option for himself, as you say, to rule beyond 2024. This was before the constitution was changed,
right?
Which is when his current presidential term expires. So there was a push by Moscow to, you know, ink some kind of agreement with Belarus on closer integration and perhaps even move towards a full merger under this Union State. So, yeah, I give all this detail because I think that's the important backdrop against which Moscow is viewing events in Belarus right now. On one hand, as you say, Moscow may very well be interested in having weakened Lukashenko retain power, you know, battered by the reputational damage caused by all the evidence coming in recent days of, you know, violence, excessive violence against protesters, and also forced into some kind of concession with the protest movement, which I think we're very likely to see Lukashenko offer in the days to come, because it seems like his options are running out. So, if, you know, from Moscow's perspective, I think a weakened Lukashenko would be potentially more pliant to Moscow's demands and in less of a position to kind of rebuff pressure to further integrate with Russia under the terms of this Union State.
Right.
On the other hand, Moscow's been known, especially under Putin, to take quite pragmatic and adaptable approaches to turmoil and unrest in the region. So in the same way it did during the Armenian Revolution 2 years ago in 2018, it may well make overtures to, you know, whoever emerges as Lukashenko's most likely replacement, you know, be it the exiled, his exiled election rival Tikhanovskaya, who is now no longer leading the protest movement. She's in Lithuania, of course, or someone else. So if Moscow sees Lukashenko's days are numbered, in other words, I think whatever happens, Moscow can't afford to lose Belarus, so to speak. I think that the countries that, you know, close integration with the European Union, Belarus is, especially under an openly anti-Russian government, is, you know, a hypothetical scenario which was unthinkable months ago, but now, to some people, at least, maybe seems much more fathomable. And I think for Moscow, I think Moscow would not allow that to happen without a fight.
Right. So, I mean, I think that's a really good analysis. I was saying, look, Russia wants a weakened Lukashenko, but I guess it's a matter of sort of you know, if he gets too weak, then that's no help for the Kremlin. So as you predict, I think, you know, they're going to be adjusting to the situation. And we'll see how that plays out. And it'll depend on how things play out in Belarus. All right. We're running out of time. We're going to wrap it up for today. Matthew, great to have you on the podcast again. Thanks a lot.
Sure. Thanks, Steve.
All right. I'll be away for a while in the coming weeks, but the week ahead in Russia will continue unabated with a guest host. So please tune in again next week. Thank you for listening.